Tonight is a comparatively long one, so I wanted to cut the small talk and get straight to it. But I did want to say that it's a comparatively long one for a very good reason, and that's because it's a very good one. So turn off your telephone, turn off your television, make yourself a nice cup of tea or have a beer, and sit back and kick up your feet. But I just said that I wanted to cut the small talk, so good evening. It's Monday the 20th of November 2006, and it's Miette's Bedtime Story Podcast. Except for the sickness, I'm quite healthy now, you can believe that. By Thomas Glynn. This morning, a man came to my door and asked if I had taken a bath. I told him I was an artist, and he left. I caught sink of it and asked him what that meant, but he didn't know. I like to know what things mean, their deeper significance. So then I asked my slum landlord, Solomon Golub, but he only lied and said it was the man from the water department. Some day I'll tell you about Golub, king of the slum landlords, but not now. Not with the pain I've got. Funny how a room can turn around. I mean, you can stand in one place, with your feet on solid floor, and the room can spin around like a top. Ever watch colours then? Red, green, violet, they all turn into blue. The pain helps, and then sometimes when I'm not on my feet, the paints will change colours in tubes, and those goddamn rats are partial to navy blue. They eat right through the tubes, metal, plastic and all, then gorge on the paint. Stark came over last night, and I showed him my new picture. He said it was all right, except for the red. He says that just to gall me, Stark does. I say, what red? And he says, there, and points to a place which is blue. And I say, that's blue, and he says, red. Stark, what does he know? He can't even walk on the ground. If you watch him closely, you'll see that he walks on air. 2 inches of air. How can anybody who walks on air know anything about painting? Still, I ask him, sucker that I am. Lately, I am asking more people like that. Even Golub, who likes art if it can cover up a bad hole in the wall. Next time you see Stark, look at his pants. They come down over his heels, brushing the ground. How can anyone tell he's walking on air if his pants are too long and touch the ground? He tries to hide it. He's embarrassed about walking on air. Stark sews. He has a showing at the Stampfli of old sheets. They're all stained, his sheets. Also, a showing of laundry tickets at the Amalfi. Did you ever see Stark and Golub argue? Stark is 5 feet 4, and Golub is 5 feet 6. But with Stark 2 inches off the ground, he comes up level to Golub. They stand and shout, mouth to mouth, and Golub puts his hands on Stark's shoulders and pushes him the remaining 2 inches down to the ground. But unless he keeps his hands there, Stark just pops up again, crew cut to crew cut with Golub. Being artists, they both argue economics. Stark lives below me, a tenant of Madman Golub. Golub is trying to put hot water in our lofts so that he can raise the rent. Each day the plumbers come, and each night Stark and I are busy with pipe wrenches undoing their work. Once the hot water is in and running, the rent goes up. So far we are even with the plumbers, but Golub is thinking of adding more to keep ahead. That's Golub. Always thinking. Another thing about blue. My model has varicose veins, which fascinate me. Did you ever see a really good showing? I don't mean the beginnings, those immature spider webs with their picky little microscopic traces. I'm talking about your great overhanging ropes, your great knotted, clotted masses of bulging, misshapen, inoperative veins that are congealed like wet cotton. What shades of blue! From dark to light, sea to sky, fire to ice. The picture I'm working on now, with my model bent over so that from the rear I can see her patch, is all varicose vein. Title? Varicose Veins at Sunrise. I keep her standing all day in a tub of cold water. It brings texture, adds depth to the blue tubes. She's 53, afraid I'll fire her and get a younger girl. I talk about breasts and stay up and flesh that holds together, and she breaks down blubbering. But I wouldn't have a younger model. Give me the flesh that shifts, the breasts that sag. Snow is blue. And when you walk on snow that's blue on blue, but of course, Stark doesn't make any tracks when he walks, so he can't know what I'm talking about. But snow is pale blue, really. The colour of chipped china or faded blotters. I thought of that yesterday during the heat wave. If I feel up to it, and the pain isn't so bad, I put snow in my pictures. Lots of fat flakes with a footprint or two. If Jenny can shiver when I paint, so much the better. She has rheumatism, and shivering comes easily to her. I make it simple by keeping her in a bucket of water, her large blistered feet rubbing the sides of the rusty iron tub. Sometimes if I leave a window open in the dead of winter, which I'm liable to do, it looks like a colony of mice is running underneath her skin. Then when I see her shake, I get inspired and often do 6 or 7 completed nudes in one day. Titles: Jenny Shivering in a Bucket of Water. Jenny Under Delusions of Cold. Jenny's Veins. Jenny Without Food for 3 days. And its corollary, Jenny Fainting from Lack of Food and Falling Head First into the Iron Bucket. Blue Jenny, Jenny in Between, and my big one, Jenny Jumps. The last one is the size of my wall. I wanted to do a big picture and nailed canvas to one of the walls, propping chairs and tables and ladders against it so that I could hop around on my one good leg and fill the canvas with lines. I had Jenny jumping from one of the ceiling beams in the loft. I wanted to get that look people have on their face when they go through the air. Have you seen that look? It's like modelling a face in damp seersucker shorts. The mouth has this absent-minded look about it, but the eyes seem to be hurricane centres. Jenny jumps, her blubber trailing behind, adding buoyancy, floating like potato angels. Jenny is all fluff and old chocolate, and when she jumps, she expands. This is art, that expansion. I'm doing a sequel to Jenny Jumps. Jenny Lands. Setting: old broken cement, blistered sidewalk, all cracks and acne, dry bones for plants and rust-red blood scattered like pandemonium seeds. In the middle, in parts, lies Jenny, full of hope, her mouth bleeding belief and the shock of the real blended miraculously into her limbs. Great stores of curious onlookers and large cities burning in the background, crucifixions and pilgrims walking, bombs exploding and lovers opening letters. The surroundings of Jenny. It will be the greatest thing I or anybody has done yet. It's what I've been trying to say for years. Golyub says he'll buy it to cover a hole in the wall. I'll take praise wherever I can find it. Stark, who should know, says Jenny Lands can hang side by side with Jambo. I'll tell you more about Golyub as soon as the pain goes away. Golyub sleeps, during the day on a small canvas cot upstairs. If Stark or I feel like waking him, we pound on the pipes with a monkey wrench until he stirs. With that noise, he'll run out into the street, thinking his building is falling down. And just to convince him, we sometimes throw things out the window. Packing crates and type fonts and baby carriages with little nephews. Then he'll run to the phone booth and call the health department, complaining that the ruse skis are coming, and he's getting the first bomb. I don't think I told you about the pain. There are two kinds, professional and amateur. In between is Golub. I'll talk about that later. Half the numbers under 10 are prime, so there must be a connection there somewhere. But try to tell that to Stark. I asked him about emotion in painting. I told him I thought it was a net full of feelings, some of which poked fingers and toes into the picture. All he said was that I had too much blue. Here he said, too much blue. Change this to vermilion, this to ochre, that to beige, and this to sienna. I leave him alone and he kicks my paintings. I have to put ropes around them and he comes into the studio. He doesn't understand blue. Paint by the stars, he says. He pulls out his astrology handbook, a Carol Richter special, mumbles some Latin names and come up with the exact names and times when I should paint. Stark, floating 2 inches off the ground, says I should paint on the 23rd of March at 2:30 in the afternoon, again on the 25th at 7, and then wait until the 16th of April when I can paint the whole day. One day I showed him a new picture, which he said was out of my horoscope, and kicked a hole in it before I could hit him with my iron easel. I painted around the hole, but what can you do with a critic? When Stark gets excited, he rises, and if he's really enthusiastic about something, he floats up to the ceiling. Jumping after him doesn't do any good. He'll just bob along the ceiling like a moth after cotton candy. Remember that faggot farm boy in Nebraska who killed 11 people? I'm doing a series on him. 3/4 profile, set in plaster of Paris, surrounded by a movie marquee, rerun of an old George Brent picture. Halloween death mask and magic lantern eyes under dime store plastic rims and larger-than-life proboscis. Munger levelling his gun and pops out a flag. Love! I like things surrounding other things in my pictures, and I like people hiding, using masks and stepping out of dark alleys wearing capes and frightening drunks. But try to add that into a painting, and that's just the beginning. When you add up the trading stamps and the formica counters and the bedwetters and the high school Spanish teachers, where does that leave you? In Toledo with El Greco. The canvas isn't big enough. I'll have to block off the intersections and lay my linen in the streets, paint with dripping buckets from tenement roofs. Stark is taking lessons to fly, so he can't understand. When you look down, what can you see? Only bird shit and slugs, if you happen to be a bird. I tell Stark, what do you want to fly for? He thinks it will help his art. When I try to explain about art, he's bumping his head against the ceiling. So who can you talk to about art? Much more on Golub later. Sinkovitz is calling now. I think I'll tell him about the pain. Did you know that the monarch butterfly will go thousands of miles just to get a good piece of arse? Talking to Golub after I've taken down his pipes. I take him up to my studio and show him my paintings. I flip through canvas after canvas, put slivers in my fingers, and smile. Golub is not one of your wishy-washy art owners. He buckles his shoes every morning, buttons on his pants. who can beat lead pipe enlightenment like that? When Stark floats, he fills himself up like a blowfish, huff and puff, taking in great balloons of air, inflating his cheeks. His skin distends, his face changes from purple to red to pink. He floats above our heads, a network of veins, Golyub looking up. Golyub would be a hunchback if he had the choice, but lacking the will to deform, he stares pop-eyed. I have a thing in yellow. Title, Golyub Staring. I have a hole in my floor where I build most of my fires, and I put him in this. There were three stages. Golyub in the hole, me painting over him on the floor, and Jenny above both of us on a swing. I fixed it so that Golyub could look up her dress, and when he did, then I had the look I wanted. I could have titled it Golyub Staring Under Jenny's Dress, or Golyub in Discomfort, but I liked the neutral tones of Golyub Staring better. His forehead is freckled, and what occupies the centre of the picture is this forehead, this sandy speckled forehead. The more I looked at his forehead, the more it reminded me of a beach, so I painted it as a beach. Sand with grey wood and broken shells and faded glass. I didn't use a brush, but scraped large clumps of crusty oil on the canvas. I used paint that had dried, sticking it on in sections like a statue. I mixed some sand in with the paint, and far off, in a wrinkle of the left brow, I had a beach city burning, concrete bunkers exploding, and dog legs falling through storm clouds and old newspapers with faded ocean print spelling forgotten tragedies buried under the sand. All that was on Golyub's forehead, staring up. And much more. Golyub has acne, pits of flesh that insult the eyes, his adolescent blitzkrieg. These became pop bottles with lost notes inserted by myopic teenage girls who worked from dawn to dusk in glass factories dreaming of orgasms. Old bones, naturally, insect bodies blowing like dry bamboo in the Philippine wind, spittle damp and bubbly drawing together hundreds of grains into a small spitball. Women's liquids, deposited in secret places, harsh droppings folded under thin straw-coloured leaves and spent in quick spurts. All that was on Golyub's forehead. I worked fast, in a rage, throwing paint, building this forehead up like a plaster wall, and underneath, dim but not lost, two faint firefly eyes shining through the wind, looking hopefully up at Jenny. Sinkovitz gave me a good price for it, almost enough to pay off my lawsuit. If Stark takes to flying too much, I can't have him in my studio. I made that resolution yesterday. The pain starts in the left leg and runs up through the right testicle like a silver wire, where it shorts over to the left ball, down the right leg, where it gathers in little hairballs, which is what happens if you're not careful and swallow hair. Then the surface of the leg goes bad, and no matter how you slap it, from thigh to knee, nothing is felt. You might as well have plastic for skin. I told the doctors about it, and they told me it was sciatica, compounded by a pinched vein. I thanked them and paid my bill, slapping my leg, which still felt like plastic. When the pain comes, I can't talk much, and that's not because it hurts. Pain is squeezed out of me and coats my walls. I have an aching knee over by the window that must take up a good 4 square feet. It's almost an inch thick, and on bad nights it vibrates, crumbling the plaster in its tendon fingers. I sit smoking, watching it. How can I paint then, watching that wall shake, my knee ache with such pain? pain jumps too, and one flew out my window and landed on a bomb below, crippling his other leg. Sometimes when the pain comes I try to paint my big picture, but often the walls shake so that nothing is steady. Jenny talks with Golyub, and that's when I'm sure they're plotting something, even though all Golyub can talk about is lead pipes and his driving tests. Golyub is a great conversationalist. He fascinates. He is beyond the bar. With him it is a matter of reality, like dropping a plumb line to the center of the earth. What you find there, you talk about. Golyub dropped and found lead pipes and driving tests. "Take your number 3 lead pipe," he'd say, and indeed I had already taken it the night before and dropped it out the window, letting it fall in the cellar doorway where he and I have our agreement. "Did I tell you about the agreement? Take your number 3 lead pipe," he says, talking as if he had a cigar in his mouth. "Conforms to your ASA specifications as cited in code number 37 of the Plumbing and Heating Contractors." Golyub tells me all about lead pipes, about shear strengths and thread pitch, about decay factors and incessant vibration strain. I like that one, the one about incessant vibration strain. I thought it applied somehow to something. I let it roll around on my tongue, coating the consonants with saliva and tickling the S's on the roof of my mouth. Golyub has a winner there, in that incessant vibration strain. "God damn that Stark! He's getting to act more like a bird every day." Soon after, he comes in, the first thing he wants to do is fly up to a rafter and drop bird shit on the forks. No matter at all. And he's constantly shedding. What good is he up there, on the rafters? I brought him down one evening with my Crossman lead pellet in the wing because he was making tracks over my canvas. Golyub tells me about his driving lessons, what he does with the clutch, and how he turns the wheel with one hand and signals with the other. Golyub's feet on the pedals. Small, tiny little hooves, gloved in leather, and reaching a delicate point at the front. Golyub has weak legs, and can't press the pedals hard enough, too cheap for power brakes and automatic transmission. Last Tuesday, during one of his road tests, he smashed into a bread truck. I got a call on the phone and rushed down, paints in hand. Used a lot of yellow and red. Noticed that when metal bends, it turns yellow. Used the flat of the spatula, quick strokes like cutting turkey. Golyub, leaning his hand through the cracked window, thoughtfully bleeding, and I had a tube of vermilion that did the job nicely. I like the warm shade of vermilion, and the rich sheen before it dries. I have since tried to rework it in blue, but a certain power is missing. Golyub fails driver's tests with alarming regularity. Stark came down from the ceiling long enough to make a suggestion. He told me to look for connections. Before I could ask him with what, he flew back up again, and since he's out of the range of the Crossman, I'll have to be content with that enigmatic phrase. Typical of Stark. I didn't tell you about my big picture yet. Invited Steinmetz up to talk about it. He's the only one left. He's a cigar store clerk downstairs, and I suspect also a friend of Golyub's, but what can you do when you're trapped? Steinmetz listens to me, sucking his teeth. He's good at lit matches, and just this week almost burnt down my studio. That would have gotten Stark out, but I'll have to watch Steinmetz, because I think he talks to Golyub. Did I ever tell you why Golyub is always taking driver's tests? Clutch chatter and low-octane knock are second nature to him. He wishes he could get his hands greasy.
Stark just dropped another egg. 2 since this morning.
Steinmetz brought his mother over, and that's something even Sinkovitz won't do. His mother is Danish and smokes cigars, and that's how he got his start in the business, but of course he's German. She wears long black gabardine dresses that come down to her ankles and has a small charcoal moustache at the corner of her mouth. I wanted to do a picture of her and Steinmetz, titled Steinmetz's Mother, but with him in the picture, since I thought he was a part of her. All blacks and shoe-polish browns, like the one I did of Golyab's feet. Title, Golyab's Feet on the Pedals. Size 8 pumps in soft calfskin, hand stitched and shivering, dancing in the air. I painted Golyab's feet from underneath to get the character, and I wanted to do the same with Steinmetz's mother, showing old smoke and forgotten tobacco and falling folds of gabardine, locked rooms and stained books with bitter scenes. Who is to remember this, hanging over the drawing-room like a long Danish winter night? But try to get that in! All black and brown and colours they don't have yet, try to mix them! Anyway, I couldn't do it, working in blue now, and I don't see those lips in anything but long brown-rolled cadavers of tobacco wrappers. Golyab tells me that Stark refuses to pay rent since he's a bird. I can see he thinks Stark is settling in a dangerous precedent. My big picture, the one with everything in it, is going to be in blue. I told Sinkovitz about it, and he says he's got a buyer lined up, but the only one I can talk to about it now is Steinmetz's mother. I've given up on Steinmetz. He spends all his time sucking his teeth. Yesterday he swallowed 2 fillings, gold, and his bowel movements are watched with great eagerness. The big picture. Everything has to be in it. I've decided to do a falling picture, things falling. I think blue will put that across best. How big should the canvas be? Don't know, might have to knock out a wall. What falls? Jenny, Golyab's feet, Steinmetz's mother, but that's just a start. I used to get invitations from Sinkovitz to go to openings, but now he feels I work best through a front. I still haven't met his mother. She wears chrome-rimmed glasses, and her face, like my leg, is plastic. I'd love to see that face, but Sinkovitz is adamant. No mother, no plastic face. People will fall 2 ways in my painting. Head first or feet first? Eisenhower will fall head first, but Jenny and the Virgin Mary will fall feet first. Steinmetz's mother wanted to know if she could fall in my picture, and I said yes. Not that I considered this a compromise, since I'd planned to have her falling anyway. I gave her a choice of head or feet first, and she took head first. She's afraid that if she falls feet first, her dress will billow up over her head. Everybody is in blue. The Duke of Windsor is in navy blue plus 4s, while his wife is in sky blue tennis shorts and an off-blue polo shirt. Naturally, they fall holding hands. Steinmetz came up, and he wants to fall too, though he'll settle for whatever way I put him, feet or head first. He'd like to fall with his cigars. Golyab wants to fall too, but he wants to fall with his driving lessons, and I told him that people would be falling in this picture, just people. He wants to know if he could fall with a gear shift lever in his hand, maybe a brake pedal or two. I'll have to think about that. I think I'll put Golyab falling in between Mao Zedong and De Gaulle. He asked if he could fall in his blue serge, and I told him yes. Sinkovitz came up and wanted to know how the big one was coming, and I told him but he wanted to see. Funny about Sinkovitz, he never listens to words. He has ears, but I think they're sealed over on the inside. He must read lips. I think I'll have Sinkovitz falling in my picture, upside down next to Eisenhower, reading his lips. Sinkovitz would fall good. He has that look about his face. That look of someone used to falling, eyeballs detached, cheeks inflated like a parachute, hair grabbing for air. Some people are good at falling, and some are not. I'll show this in my picture. My picture takes place in an elevator shaft, everybody crowding in at the top, falling in the middle. There is no landing. Nobody ever lands. There will be arms and legs and dog heads twirling past elevator cables. Some people will slide, holding on to greased cables with bloody hands and a look of automated horror. Others will ignore the cables and fall like Buddhists burning in Saigon, arrow sure. The grabbers will reach out, twirl, shiver, and fall like animated cartwheels in a firecracker carnival. Everyone will fall in my picture. Heads of state, models, safecrackers, highway patrolmen. I'm considering other things falling. Alarm clocks and forks and crutches. Stark came down and wants to know if he can fall. But I told him no. Then he told me I could fly if I wanted to. He told me to fill my cheeks with air and breathe fast. I tried, but only my heels came off the ground. We talked about blue, and Stark said that black was blue, that everything was black, and that was why he was flying. He laid an egg and flew back up to the ceiling. The painting is turning out to be larger than I had thought. It already covers two walls, and everyone who sees it wants to fall in it. Jenny wants to fall in her furs, and I asked if she meant that old muskrat coat she wears. Like all old people when they get upset, Jenny's nostrils flutter and go pale, the tissue drained of blood. Blue again. I told her she could fall in her furs. She's happy. If you look towards the centre of your nose and press the corner of your eye, you can see a small cornea of the visible spectrum. Newton in the optics. Steinmetz's mother wanted to know why people fell, and I asked her if she knew Sinkovitz's mother. But she said she can never associate with anyone who has a plastic face. I can see why. Hers is leather. Cracked and peeling, like a blue Michelangelo ceiling, with faint flicks that fall like flesh showers on her teacup. She takes no notice. Still, we can talk. She speaks in blue syllables like old river icicles. She takes one bony, peeling hand and reaches inside her dress, the black gabardine crinkling like a forest fire. Fingers fumble, feeling old linen and immigrant undergarments. When she finds a word she wants, she has no hesitancy in bringing it out, holding it between her dead fish fingers like a cracked amethyst. We spent one evening talking of Japan. She attributed her old age to cigar smoking. Did I tell you the Pope, His Holiness, is falling in my picture? To be sure. Along with the entire College of Cardinals and selected artifacts of Vatican City. They fall feet first, their robes billowing up like mushrooms. His Holiness holds a mitre in one hand and a fork in the other. It is Friday, and he is eating cod. Sinkovitz came and said the picture was too big. It now covers three walls, and I have half the upper chamber of the New York State Legislature falling, along with 24 rock and roll stars, 5 respected surgeons, and 10 policemen, arm in arm, who are ceremoniously trampling on a select group of Ban the Bomb demonstrators. Sinkovitz saw the last vignette and wanted to know if I was going political, and I told him I would if I could.
Did you ever notice the look on someone's face when they get testy? All wound up, like a rusty screw that's been worked on backwards? That's Sinkovitz. I'm having reservations about him. He talks with Golub too much, and lately is getting very commercial. Stark thinks commerce is good for art, but after my last arrest I don't agree. Jenny's teeth hurt. I told her they would. At her age, what can you expect? She took them out and showed them to me. They were hurting. She has arguments with her teeth several times a day. She says they make her say things she doesn't want to say. I told her I'd put the teeth in her picture, falling. Golub tried to hit me with a lead pipe. With Sinkovitz, it's the mouth. I tried to explain that to him the other day. I told him, "Look, Sinkovitz, your mouth is shaped like a saucer, and that's why you say what you do." It may be the last time we'll see of Sinkovitz. Okay with me. I've been trusting him less since he started brushing his teeth. Yesterday we celebrated the King of Denmark's birthday, and everybody came. Steinmetz and Steinmetz's mother, Jenny, and even Golub, who brought his own control panel with him. Golub is very intent on passing his driver's tests. Wherever he goes, he takes a steering wheel, pedals, windshield, gear shift lever, and bench seat. We had ice cream and cake, and Jenny passed out party hats, shiny little elastic domes with a rubber that fit around the neck. Golub sat, shifting gears and making Plymouth noises. He takes his test on a Plymouth six-cylinder, though at present he's having clutch trouble. Stark flew down and read a poem, though he's no poet. Jenny gave him a hat, and he complained about the elastic. Some day I'll have to have a good talk with Stark. Why do old men walk in the streets in winter? Last night Sinkovitz came and knocked on my door late at night. I had trouble with some of the chains, and at least one padlock had rusted shut, but I finally got the door open. Sinkovitz asked me if I believed in art for art's sake, and I told him I might. Who knows? He said if I did, I should cut up my big picture and sell the pieces. I let him into the main studio because I liked a vein that was throbbing on the side of his temple. It wasn't a big vein, actually, about the size of a fingernail, but it jumped up and down like a small snail strangling. Some day I'll tell you more about Sinkovitz, that he's a prick in the aforementioned sense, you know. But did you know that he wears white hair, silvered, and has a camel's hair coat, which he's thrown up on 3 times already? His face is the colour of shiny pigskin, and that always fascinates me. I am a sucker for Sinkovitz's face, I must admit. It's like new money rubbed into old leather. There's a sheen about it, soft, as if he spent his entire life crying in expensive sand. So I let him in and sat him on a kitchen chair over which hung an electric light bulb swaying over the end of a frayed line. Sinkovitz's head danced on the floor like a seahorse in a storm as the bulb swung first one way and then the other. When the bulb was at one end of its arc, I could see that vein throbbing like salmon sperm, dark blue, the colour of the Baltic. At the other end of the arc, the vein was hidden in the shadow of his head, beating, but beating unseen. I wanted to reach over and touch his vein. All I could think of was electricity and telephone lines. Sinkovitz blubbered on about how he had to have that picture to sell, that he was committed to sell it, that he needed the money, that it was too big to sell in its present size. It now covers all four walls, and the end is not in sight. Its
heading for the roof, my canvas, my resurrected linen, unfolding its scroll like equator up to the heavens. But with his vein in my unfinished canvas, and Sienkiewicz's blubbering, I had to set up a new canvas. I worked fast, sketching him in charcoal. Titanium blue, zinc red, and some old yellow that has been drying up in a forgotten tube. I started with a brush, but couldn't get the paint on fast enough to match the frenzy of that throbbing, so I moved on to a spatula, and then fingers, trying to keep up with the mad army of blood that raced through that temple. Let me tell you what I put in. First of all, electricity running through the frayed lines, sputtering, and then shadows crossing soft faces, old olives, the sun in Sicily, expensive conversations, and of course Sienkiewicz's face in triplicate, pleading, smiling, crying, being soothed by costly salves, and rubbed with blushing liquids from near-nude virgins. Hair like hoarfrost, looked at the mirrors, often combed. If you look closely at Sienkiewicz's face, you'll find it's hideously smoothed by small scars, brushed shining like light leather over upholstery. And the vein beating over its own metronome, reckoning the cost of cocktails and canvas, calligraphy and Corot. I finished at 5 a.m., and Sienkiewicz was asleep. So I wrapped his lank, slack body in the dirty camel's hair coat and carried him over to my couch. I pulled the coat around his shoulders with a feeling I was wrapping a piece of fish. No more room in the studio. I'm painting on the roof, set up curtain stretchers weighted down with bricks. Stark flies up now and then to see how I'm coming. I show him the new fallers, the mayor and the city council, 5 rabbis making liberal pronouncements, 12 candy store owners, innumerable mothers with babes in arms. 2,000 Gideon Bibles placed here for your convenience and enlightenment, and 7 irreproachable Miss America contestants. Word has gotten out about my picture, and everybody wants to fall in it. Stark sells tickets, and Jenny seats them in a chair, or tells them to stand. There is no longer room on the roof, so I let the painting drape down the side of the building. Last night it rained, altering the composition of one section. Stark is against touching it up. He feels that whatever happens is, and should be left. I can see now that this painting will have no end. I hate to disappoint Sienkiewicz and the mortgage on his Long Island home. An accident. Better explain about it from the ending. We had a fire. Golyub keeps insisting that I had a fire, but he says that for the benefit of the insurance agent who stands perpetually at his elbow. The insurance agent says he can't understand how the fire got started, but it's perfectly simple. Stark did it. Of course, he didn't really do it, but since we're going backwards to explain, which is really the only way to explain, he did it. How did he start it? The agent asks. With the ash from his cigar, I say. The agent tells me that birds don't smoke, but I try to explain to him that Stark is no bird. Temporarily. A phase. Behind all those feathers stands Stark, the real commercial menace. Now, why is Stark smoking a cigar? Easy. He is upset. And where did he get the cigar? Another easy one. Steinmetz and his mother. Steinmetz's mother went in halvesies on a box of slim Pantelles, Stark's favourites. Stark goes for your riverboat gambler cigar and likes to fiddle with a gold watch chain when he smokes. For the benefit of the insurance agent, I explained why Stark was upset. this was because of the argument I was having with Golyub. Now, why was I having an argument with Golyub? Simple, because I was having an argument with Sinkovitz. Golyub and I were arguing over what Sinkovitz had said. I told Golyub he couldn't hear because he kept driving gloves in his ears. He doesn't have pockets on his pants, so the only place he can keep his gloves are in his ears. They hang down to his shoulders, easily the world's longest, with deep folds in which he keeps all the things he normally would keep in his pockets. But, as a result of all this, he has trouble hearing. Maybe that's why he fails his driving tests. Try to take something out of his ears, and he says his ears get cold. His earmuffs look like knee-length socks. What was Sinkovitz and I arguing about? About Golyub's ears. Sinkovitz claims they're normal ears, like everyone else's. He says they don't hang down, but I claim they do. When ears hang, they hang. No one can tell you different. I tell Golyub he should face his long ears. Then he could accept disappointment. Golyub wants to set up a driving school in my studio. He has a plan to buy old junks and haul them up here for beginners. Golyub loves driving. He figures with his own driving school he'll be able to pass his driving tests. How can you argue with a man who carries gear shift knobs in his ears? Steinmetz's mother wants to know if this is all real, and she has a point there. Jenny argues yes, but then she always was an incurable romantic. Steinmetz doesn't say much. Did I tell you his eyebrows and hair were completely burned off? Steinmetz's mother thinks the whole idea of people falling is unreal. She suggested I do old ladies with lapdogs or something classic like man brushing his wig or Portia surprised. She's a great one for people being surprised. She says that real people are always being surprised. But this she says with waving a bony peeling hand in front of my people falling picture. This is not real. I try to tell her that people are always falling. They even fall surprised. New fallings. 5 generals in full battle dress. 7 postmen delivering dead letters. 20 precocious epileptics. Golyub is upset. I tried to hit him over the head with a lead pipe. He also claims I tried to tie his ears in knots. He is currently pushing a Studebaker into my studio. It's wedged rather tightly in the elevator door. At 8 o'clock, Golyub is out in the rear of the elevator, feet wedged against the elevator wall, polished little landlord hands on the rear bumper of the Studebaker, trying to push it into the studio. And me? I stand on the floor trying to push it back into the elevator. Golyub gives a grunt, pushes, and a small drop of businessman's sweat drops from his oily brow. At 10 we break for coffee, at 12 for lunch, and by special agreement we knock off at 4. He's persistent, this Golyub, and shows amazing strength for a landlord. The Studebaker is 3 inches in his favour. I calculated this amount to a bumper, so I cut it off with my acetylene torch and threw it in the backyard. Golyub claims he'll sue. He comes back with a lawyer who helps him push. Sinkovitz came over and helped me push, but he's like a lawyer, no back or shoulder muscles, so to speak of. Again, he's crying for the big picture. Fat men keep coming into the ground floor, but never leaving. I can see them now, wedged, bulging, hip to portly shoulder. Golyub's de cow. If the pain wasn't so bad, I'd go downstairs and let them out. Golyub's probably hoarding them for all the time when there'll be a shortage of fat men. When fat men fall, they flutter. I've shown that. sizzling little pork butterflies.
Steinmetz finally gave me the idea. He sucks his teeth, but he sucks a new set each day. He has 7 sets of false teeth, a Monday set, a Tuesday set, and so on. That means he returns to his sucked teeth. I call them Steinmetz's revolving sucked false teeth. The same thing with my picture, mounted onto a gigantic revolving drum, spectators at the apex, my revolving, falling people. And soon I'll start on that drum too, when the fire in the elevator shaft dies down and the claws on my hand turn back into fingers.